Well, I was on the tube a month or two ago, and I saw this advert for Las Vegas. I don't know whether you've seen it, but it told me, your accent is an aphrodisiac. What happens here stays here. And we've read something fairly similar just now, actually, in Psalm 73. Verse 11 says, they say, how would God know? Does the Most High know anything? So not really a lot of difference. It could be that the ad man thinks that it's just in Las Vegas that God chooses to turn a blind eye. But basically, it's the same message now as it was 3,000 years or so ago. You only live once, do anything you want to do, and no one has the right to tell you anything different. Now, of course, many of you may say, well, hang on, I'm a Christian. Of course I believe that God sees what goes on, and I'm not going to be fooled by the ad man from Las Vegas. But if you're thinking that, just think again for a minute and take a closer look at what Psalm 73 says, because although it starts off in verse 1 on fairly predictable grounds, surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart, it's verse 2 that gives us the shock. But as for me, my foothold had almost slipped. So here's the psalmist who does believe that God is God and God is good to those who are good, and yet he still finds himself in terrible danger of falling off the deep end. Why? Well, verse 3, for I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. So God-fearing he may be, but if the psalmist was an Englishman today about to visit Las Vegas, he'd be sorely tempted to believe that his accent was actually an aphrodisiac and that whatever he'd get up to there would stay there. You see, your brain may be telling you one thing. You may think that you could never be seduced, but all you have to do is open your eyes to what's all around you, and your heart's going to start telling you a totally different message. Because, of course, there are plenty of reasons to suggest that there's no justice in this world. The rich do tend to get richer and appear to have everything sewn up. So the temptation is always there. Why don't we all just join the crowd and go with the flow? So do you ever find yourself thinking that as you walk down Regent Street or Oxford Street? Or have you even found yourself thinking that this morning as you look around your office or as you read the Metro and saw the pictures of all the B-list celebrities having such a wonderful time in wherever it was last night? Now, I don't know what image comes to mind when you read verses 4 to 9. The way the psalm's structured is that you've got this group of people who are described as arrogant in verse 9, or alternatively wicked in verse 12. And they're set up in contrast to those who fear God. So there's a bit of stereotyping going on here. You've got to allow for that. But basically, this is what the psalmist is seeing as he looks out on the world. And it's this brash, godless success culture that he's personally being drawn towards. And that's the cause of the inner turmoil that he's experiencing. So for me, as I read verses 4 to 9, it just conjures up the scene of a classic Friday night down the pub in the city on the way home from work. I guess for me it's a slightly distant memory because I'm a bit old for that now, and it's not something we make a habit of at Christianity Explored, but you know what it's like. You still know the score. The beer flows, the conversations get louder, the stories get even more exaggerated. And that's not exactly what's written here, but it's got just that sort of feel. The bragging, the boasting. You know, it's the sort of place we've all been to. We've all experienced it. And we all know the temptation just to let go, enjoy ourselves, and let tomorrow take care of itself. Because the point is that we haven't got the option of saying this is written for somebody else, it's not for us. This is written by a believer for the believer. So we all need to take this warning seriously. We're all one small step from disaster when we look at the world around us, because all of us are plagued by the desires lurking in the human heart. And it's obvious these temptations exist for the believer and non-believer alike. In fact, actually, if you look at verse 10, there's a phrase translated there which is their people. And apparently that's so ambiguous that could refer either to the arrogant and wicked or to the people of God. It's just not clear. But the point is, all alike are taken in by this. It's what everybody seems to be drawn into. And yet, on the other hand, for the people of God, it gets a lot more complicated. And you can see that when you look at verses 13 to 16, because the problem is that however hard the believer may try, it's actually impossible for him or her to live without reference to God in this world and yet still be happy. Verse 15 puts it like this. It says, "If I had spoken out like that, I would have betrayed your children." So what happens is, if you are a believer and you're part of the family of God, and yet you try to live like you're not, you're actually going to put yourself through agony. Hard as you try, you're never going to shake off those family ties. So if you do try and ignore God, then all you'll do is find that you go through turmoil, living a double life. You'll have one foot in the world and the other in the church, and you'll end up being happy in neither. So that's effectively the situation the psalmist was finding himself in, completely caught between these two stools. On the one hand, he knows that God's real, he's trying to live a pure life, and he wants to honour God and his people. But then on the other, he looks around, sees everyone else doing whatever they fancy, and they appear to be having a wonderful time while he's struggling and suffering. So he wants what they've got, but at the same time, he knows that he's never ever going to be happy living that way. So he seems to be totally trapped. In verse 16, he tries to figure it out, but he can't, and he ends up deeply troubled. And it's only when we get to verse 17, finally, the light breaks through into the darkness. Why? He goes to church. It actually says, "I entered the sanctuary of God." So you could take that as physically going into the temple, or it could just be a metaphor for coming into God's presence. But either way, what happens is that finally, he starts to rise above the earthly perspective and instead catches a glimpse of God's perspective. And you can see this change in perspective most clearly when you jump onto to verses 21 to 26. So he's now looking back to the time where he was caught in envy, and he described himself in verse 22 as senseless, ignorant, and a brute beast. And then he goes on from there to describe a new sense of peace and belonging that he then experiences in verses 23 to 26, when finally he gets a bigger picture of what's actually going on. And then right at the end, when you get to verse 28, you've got a repeat of the verse 2 phrase, but as for me, only this time, instead of it being followed by, "I'd nearly lost my foothold," this time it's, "It is good to be near God." So that's the basic message of this psalm in a nutshell. If you're a believer in Jesus Christ, you will be tempted by the world around and all that you see in it. You will be seduced by the ad man. But when you are, don't do what the world does. Don't look inside yourself or at the world around you to search for a solution. You've got to look upwards to God. You've got to see the bigger picture. And then, and only then, will things start slotting into place. So that's the primary message here. Keep your eyes on God in spite of what you see all around you. And I could just stop here and let you go back to work with that message. But if I did that, I'd have glossed over the risk of falling into an entirely different problem. Because you see, my guess is here, that I know most of you here, I've got to know most of you, I recognise most of you anyway. I reckon that most of you recognise the dangers of what I've been talking about. You do feel the temptations around you, and although you will stumble from time to time, most of you will come back to God and ask for forgiveness and move on. And of course, you also probably realise that the more you pray, the more you read the Bible, the more you come to church, the more you develop good Christian friendships and spend time in Christian company, almost certainly the easier it will be to resist the temptations that come your way. So you may well be very good at doing all the right Christian things. But the problem with that is that what can happen almost before you realise it is that you find yourself drifting away from any meaningful contact with the world outside the church. And if you start reading Psalm 73 the wrong way, you could actually start thinking that this is what it's saying you should do. Because isn't it when the psalmist goes into the sanctuary of God, that it all starts fitting into place. And of course, that's true. But if you read on to verses 18 to 20, you'll see immediately why withdrawing from the world around you is the wrong option. Because as you read verses 18 to 20, what you see is the full horror of what's waiting around the corner for those who reject God. So if you look at verse 18, we're told that they're on slippery ground and then cast down to ruin. In verse 19, all of this happens suddenly. They're destroyed and then completely swept away by terrors. And then it finishes off in verse 20, where we're told that God despises them as fantasies. So it's like a figment of the imagination that never really existed. So it's chilling stuff. It's a really dreadful picture. And the worst thing is that this isn't the fate of an anonymous group of people that we don't know. Yet maybe that the people in verses 4 to 9 sound a fairly unpleasant bunch on first reading. But they're symbolic of everyone. Everyone who chooses to live life without reference to God. So you know these people. They include your colleagues. They include your friends. They include your family. They're the people you care about. These may well be the people you go down the pub with on a Friday night, who may get a little bit loud with a few beers in them. But most of the time you like them. Most of the time you get on very well with them. Most of the time they're probably kind to you. And like you, they are made in the image of God and loved by God. So we really need to experience the horror of what is being laid out here for us. Also, I guess I should say that I've tended to speak as if most of you here are believers, and I'm sure that's true. But there are almost certainly some here who wouldn't describe themselves in that way. So it's great that you're here, and I'm really sorry if this comes as a huge shock to you. But I'm afraid the Bible does teach very clearly that the fate of those who choose to reject Jesus Christ is that ultimately he will reject them. Yes, there is injustice in this present age, but that will all change in the age which is yet to come. There is a judgment coming, and it's that ultimate judgment that the psalmist is seeing so clearly here. Verse 27 says, "Those who are far from you will perish. You destroy all who are unfaithful to you." So that's why withdrawing from the world isn't an option. Jesus has chosen us to be his church, not to stand in judgment on the world and wag a finger from a distance, but to be a mirror, to reflect him, to be his presence in the world, holding out a light to those in darkness. And we just can't do that from the sidelines. We have to be involved. So finally, how do we do that without having to go through quite the same level of turmoil that the psalmist faced? Three quick points to finish with. Firstly, as I've already said, we do need to do all the normal, good Christian things, like going to church, praying, reading the Bible, but without getting so bogged down that we haven't got time for anything else. Secondly, I'd say don't get too taken in by what the psalmist says in verses 4 to 9, because you've got to bear in mind this is what he's seeing in his envy. You know, it's the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. But don't be fooled into believing that all those people who appear to have life figured out are actually living contented, carefree lives. Some will claim they are, but most, I reckon, would know only too well that they're not. And whilst death will come suddenly for and without warning for some, we have to know that God is constantly at work wooing people back to him. And things are always going to happen that cause people to sit up and take stock of the meaning of life. And when that happens, as believers, we need to be around to help them figure out a better way, help them figure out what the real truth is behind what they see. For me, that happens at, I was 20 years old when that happens. But for others, it may happen at the age of 80. The point is, God clearly doesn't want anyone to perish. And because of that, he's actively at work, both in the lives of those who know him and in the lives of those who don't yet know him. So that's the second point. And then thirdly and finally, just take a closer look at the promises that we have as believers in verses 23 to 26. I didn't draw attention to them earlier because I wanted to end with them, because they're really the heartbeat of what the psalmist discovered as he saw beyond the seductions of this world and discovered life with God in all its fullness. So in exactly the same way that the psalmist clung on to them as the rock upon which he could build, we too should cling to them as we go out from the sanctuary of the church and back into the world. So we're told, verse 23, God is always, always with us, and he holds us by our right hand, so it's an iron grip that he's got of us. Verse 24, we're told that he guides us, and then ultimately the amazing promise that he takes us to glory. So what you then get to in verse 25 to 26, it's like in surrender, the psalmist just responds, whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. So what happens is he comes to such an amazing realization of who God is that those things of the earth that at the outset just really grabbed him, now they just completely fade in comparison to what he sees of God. And it's that clarity of purpose and conviction that leads him to utter the final words that he has in verse 28. Just totally straightforward. Well, I'll tell of all your deeds. So in the end, he's just got no other option. He's met with God in his sanctuary. He knows for sure that there's nothing else that compares. And it's that certainty that will sustain him as he goes out from the sanctuary to tell others of the good news that he's discovered.